I'm looking at Ananta Prabhu, Ananda Govinda Prabhu, with appreciation for their being here for as long as most of you can remember. Some of you came before them, but most of you didn't. And they've been steadily serving here. And serving, that's the word. They've been serving here. Selflessly serving. The leaders, they set the tenor for the whole institution or organization or any particular temple. So I'm just expressing appreciation for their steady service. You don't realize how good their service is because you're used to it. You tend to take it for granted. But it's a great credit that they have. Of course, all of you together, it's a group effort. It's a Sankirtan movement. It's not one person or two people. It's many. Bahubhir Milidva Yat Kirtanam Iti Sankirtanam. Sankirtan means when many come together to chant the holy names. But especially we have to give credit to them. This morning I was talking about leaders, how Krishna is the protector of the protectors. And although Ishvara Bhav is mentioned in Bhagavad Gita as a demoniac quality, thinking I am in charge, I am the boss, I am God, but it's also mentioned as a quality of a desirable quality of a kshatriya or leader, someone who takes charge and takes responsibility on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Special congratulations for distributing more books than ever before on Padyatra. And double it. Srila Prabhupada's order to double it. It's quite an order, isn't it? Because if you, there's the famous story of the chessboard that one man, he asked for a boon from the king. On the first square of the chessboard, I'll have one grain of wheat. On the next, two. On the next, no, actually it's geometrically. So yeah, I start with two, two times four is four, four times four equals 16, 16 times 16 equals 256, you're right. 256 times 256 equals, and get out the calculators because our brains already got lost. So the king thought, you're just asking for a few grains, but by the time you get to the 64th square, yeah, 64th square, the number of grains is more than probably ever been produced in the history of the world, all put together. So double it. If you have to double it every time. No, we're talking about that's geometric progression, but even to double it, it's quite a challenge. Anyway, that's the challenge that Srila Prabhupada gave us. This morning I spoke on Sri Vishnu Sahasranam, the name Pavan, purifier, and I mentioned in the course of that talk about impure things, because purification means to be purified from impure things, and I mentioned among things that are considered constitutionally impure, blood. And I was told that there was a question, I didn't take any questions, but one Mataji devotee had asked, or had in mind the question, why is blood impure? What is the answer to that? Which Vedic literature describes why blood is impure? There probably is something, but it wouldn't be commonly circulated, why is blood impure? Because some things should be self-evident. We don't offer Krishna blood. Blood is a associated with pain. Blood, if we see a lot, if we're not used to it, seeing blood, then we may vomit. We become disgusted upon disgusted, and so traumatized by seeing. If we see some body, we're not even used to the. We don't even know the person, but we see the body is so seriously injured. There's so much blood. We become very upset, and we may vomit. I was recently in Russia, and I was given a question, written question, because you don't answer questions like that in Russia, from a devotee who'd recently been in Ukraine and seen the bodies of so many people. She didn't know them, but it just feels so traumatized by seeing so many bodies mangled with blood everywhere and the brains spattered here and there. It's not pleasant, it's unpleasant. Of course, we find in Krishna book also descriptions of battles, and there were rivers of blood flowing in the battles, and those who had the spirit of Kshatriyas, they felt enlivened by all of this, but other people felt disgusted. So for Kshatriyas, in a certain situation, blood is something desirable. Kshatriya shouldn't come back from a battle without having some wound, because if he doesn't come back with a wound, that means either he was avoiding the fighting, or the people he defeated them so easily, he shouldn't have fought with them because they were too inferior an opponent. You should fight among equals. So he should get some wound before he comes back. But generally, the blood that's associated with the mode of ignorance, and we find people in the mode of ignorance, they take pleasure in things like this, horror movies, and they're a movie. They didn't used to allow it, but then they started to, in the name of art, they allowed highly violent scenes in movies, and just vulgar sexual scenes in movies in the name of art. Otherwise, any person who has a little culture can understand this is not proper. These are not things that we want to see. We taking pleasure in this is in the mode of ignorance, to take pleasure in seeing blood and suffering and gross sexual scenes. This is, of course, sex is very much a part of life in the world, but that's not supposed to be something public. Just now I came from England. We are in one city. It's called a city. It's a small town in the southeast of England called Canterbury, and we were doing Harinam in the city, and among the people walking in the streets was a man who was, his torso was bare. He was just wearing some jeans and maybe some kind of shoes, and shaved head, not a Krishna devotee or a Buddhist, with what I presumed, and presumably everyone else presumed, to be some kind of makeup, but it looked like he had a head injury, with bleeding coming down his face, and it dried up like that, which looks horrible, but he took pleasure in looking horrible. And that was very much part of the punk era. So I believe that started in the 1980s. I don't know, I was out of this uncivilized parts of the world by that time. So they put razor blades in their face and all kinds of things. Just taking pleasure in pain. Even some of the names of some of the groups or some of the punk music groups, I can't remember now, but just taking pleasure in pain, inflicting pain on themselves. So it's very low class. We have in religious practice also, that may be there. There's tantra in Indian practice. There's tantra where there is mangsa, matsya, mahila. There are the panchama, the five things that they. Madira is one of them. So the meat, fish, woman. What was the fourth one I said? Madira means wine. And another one is mudra, which just means some gestures. So these are all things which are to be rejected by people on the path of purity, but they're accepted on the path of left-wing tantra, that people deliberately do things which are disgusting. Having sex with corpses. Not very relishable idea, is it? That the idea is to attract ghosts. No, it didn't. The sundown didn't come yet. Otherwise, we shouldn't talk about this. To attract them, to invoke their presence. So people who take pleasure in blood, they are on the ghostly platform. And even to ask the question, why is blood impure, suggests someone has no basic understanding. They haven't come off the platform of tamoguna. Otherwise, blood is disgusting. There was one shock tactic for making people into vegetarians, so I'm told, is to get them to watch a documentary film. I haven't watched it. I'm already a vegetarian, and by Srila Prabhupada's mercy, Krishnatarian, Prasadatarian, a movie of slaughter. It's called Meet Your Meat. That's M-E-E-T, your M-E-A-T. Those of you who no English can understand, but Meet Your Meat. And they show the slaughterhouse and how the animals are screaming and there's so much blood and suffering, and often people seeing that, they decide no more, because when you get your nice looking, it may look nice to some people, packet of meat from the store. Do you have Tesco here? In Slovenia, don't have it. Spa? You have Spa. So you get packets of meat from Spa, is it? You see it in there? Do you go to Walmart, maybe? Anyway, in the supermarkets, you get in a plastic packet, meat, packaged, very convenient. So you just take it home and it looks very nice, but it's not very nice because it's the result of inflicting severe pain. Blood. The blood is impure. It shouldn't require a lot of explanation. We don't offer Krishna blood. There's no question of offering Krishna blood. We don't go on the altar that's one principle, actually, of one. It's actually stated in our Vaishnav Shastra also, that if the body is wounded and bleeding, if there are open wounds, you don't go on the altar. You can't participate directly in a yajna or sankirtan yajna. But even then, we don't want to see people blood coming out of their head. And that's also why during the menstrual period, that is forbidden for, well, that's part of the reason why women are forbidden from activities which require ritual purity. So that was one question. Kind of questions that come up. Question everything. Have you seen this? Some people say, question everything. I mean, don't believe anything. But then you say, why should you question everything? Why should you question everything? Why? Who are you to tell? Who are you to tell me to question everything? Why should you question everything? Some things we accept as axiomatic. Even science, they talk so much about, you know, they say this is logical, religion is just belief, but science, what we call the scientific method, also rests on assumptions which are accepted axiomatically. For instance, that we exist, there is such a thing as existence. It's non-provable by scientific method or any other method that we exist. We can only presume it. But it's accepted as an axiom. You say, well, it's obvious. Well, that's not science. Science means it should be proved. It's presumed. That's the first assumption. Then another presumption is that we can know the nature of this world. That this world is not, as Descartes in his bottom-up philosophical system started with the premise that I exist, and there might be a possibility that it's all just a complete illusion, but we just presume it's not a complete illusion. That's the Matrix thing, right? Red button, blue button. I don't know if you ever watched the film The Matrix. I didn't. It seems that many devotees in the Western world did watch it, but the basic thing is if you press the red button, you get... Red pill, is it? Oh, okay, red pill. Yeah. If you take the red pill, then you can see things as they actually are. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And if you take the blue pill, then you're in Maya. And you just pretend that, or you perceive this world as being true and real. So that's a presumption in the scientific method, that this world is real and it can be understood. Of course, science has been a major roadblock for over 100 years since quantum theory came up, and still doesn't seem to make any sense, although it's useful in their scientific studies. But you and yeah, that's, we can know by science. It's an assumption, but the limits of science have been reached, and then we just have to come to speculations about multi-dimensions, multiverses, to try to explain things which we can't explain by a purely materialistic method. Materialistic, the word is usually used in the sense of people are very interested in money and prestige, but in the philosophical sense, materialism means that we presume that there is matter and nothing else. There's no spiritual or metaphysical or transcendental dimension, which is, to avoid the confusion, the term materialism in science is now usually called physicalism. We don't believe in any transcend, but it's a belief. It's not provable. And it's It is an inherent flaw in the scientific method because you can't. The whole idea is to prove everything by what in the Vedic epistemological process is called pratyaksha and anuman, observation and inference. Actually, by inference, we can accept the existence of transcendence. It's right there in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. Dehino smenyatha dehe komarang yovanang jaratata dehantara praptihi. It's not directly stated as a proof of the soul, it's just stated as a fact, which Arjuna is supposed to accept, and Arjuna does accept. But Srila Prabhupada used it as a method for demonstrating the existence of the soul. Because we see that a child changes to a youth changes to an old man, and an old man dies. What changes? The body changes, the mind changes. What stays the same? How is it that a 40-year-old human can look back and remember when they were 7 years old and think, I am the same person, when so much has changed? You can say that the basic vehicle has changed, stayed the same. There's a continuum for the vehicle. But the body of a 6-year-old child and the body of a 60-year-old adult, although the vehicle, it's remained as one vehicle, but it's changed. It's grown. By the age of 60, wear and tear have set in, so wrinkles have come, unless one takes tremendous effort to keep out the wrinkles. You might be able to keep them out to some extent by putting creams and taking treatments and having, what's that called? Skin uplifts. What is that called? Whatever it's called. Anyway, you get it all lifted up and tightened up because the skin comes loose, and then in a few weeks it all drops down again. What's it called?
Facelift,
yeah. Is that the right term? So the body changes, and actually the body changes at every moment. What is it that stays the same, that I can identify with what I call myself 50 years ago? I remember when I was 50 years ago, I was completely in Maya. Now I'm not completely in Maya. At least I know what Maya is and what I should and shouldn't be doing. And by the grace of Srila Prabhupada, I'm chanting Hare Krishna. But 50 years ago, I was schoolboy. I remember. I am the same person, but the body is not the same, the mind is not the same. What is it that stays the same? By inference, we can understand it's the soul. But scientific bias, materialistic science, rules out anything that is transcendental. I read in one of the Bhaktivedanta Institute papers or essays, this was many years ago, I believe it was an essay written by Dr. Thudam Damodar T.D. Singh, in other words, His Holiness Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj, that there was a world conference on the origins of the universe. And the first statement in the conference was, we're not going to discuss any possible transcendental cause. That's not scientific, and it's not being admitted into this discussion at all. That's the first thing. Well, why? Why? The scientists, they should look at all possibilities, but they're biased. So they have their beliefs, or what they, axioms, they accept certain things, but they're as facts. Mathematical theory, that we can use mathematics to, that's a strong belief in science, that we can use mathematics to describe everything. Ultimately, everything can be described by mathematics, but it's not tangible. 2 + 2 = 4. What does that mean? That's one of the first things you learn in school, right? 2 + 2 = 4. There's no such thing as a 2. It's a concept. We use it so often, and we just take it for granted. But it's a concept. That's applicable in many fields. 2 oranges + 2 oranges = 4 oranges. But there's no such thing as a 2. It's a concept within the mind. If we think in terms of atoms and molecules and waves, then there is no such thing as an orange anyway, because it's just a continuum. From one perspective, the universe is just one. It's all one. It's a continuum of energies. And we perceive, and certain energies coalesce in certain areas that we call an orange. But it's just how we perceive it. Otherwise, it's just a continuum of energy. So there are actually so many philosophical questions that should arise, even if we are to undertake science. We can't even begin to undertake, we shouldn't actually begin to undertake science without understanding the philosophy that's behind it. But if we try to get into the philosophy, we won't go anywhere. It's not practical. And then we wouldn't have electric lights, because we'd all be worrying about, what is science anyway? Who are we? What is? But that is the real question that should be asked. Atato brahma jignasa. Not how this world runs on. Anyway, it's running on. Even if we don't have electric lights, the world will run on, believe it or not. It's very hard for people to accept. People who are raised with electric lights think that it's the prospect of living without electric lights is something horrible. I first came to India in 1976. In most of the country, there was no electric power supply. Most people had never seen an electric light. Can you imagine that? Most people had never seen light, which means no TV, no internet. There wasn't anywhere in the world. But even in the cities where there was electric power connections, a lot of the time there wasn't. The connection was there, but the current wasn't. And even if the current was there, it was too low to... You might be able to get the fan moving slowly. You'd have to push it first to get it going, physically push it. But nowadays we see Indians, they're so much used to, because another generation, they've grown up with electricity, so they come to our farm and they say, oh, very nice, very nice. Like to spend the night? No electricity? No. There's something important to do elsewhere. They can't imagine living without it. So, what was the point I was making? That we can't imagine to live without electricity, I lost my thread. Huh? Science and philosophy. We wouldn't have all these things if we stopped to worry about philosophy. Scientists are mostly not philosophers. They're interested with the practical nitty-gritty. That's all of this world. Well, that's also one kind of philosophy that was codified in modern times in the pragmatic school, American pragmatism. It came out of America, which is more or less, what the hell, let's get on with life. You know, what do you need all this anti-philosophy in the name of philosophy? Let's just do the needful, the pragmatism, whatever works, let's go along with it. That was also quoted in one of the reviews for Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is. When it was first published, there was well-known people who were asked to write reviews. So one of them, I can't remember who it was, he wrote a review that if the truth is what works, as James and the pragmatists would insist, then it seems that the Hare Krishna devotees have got a good dose of it. I'm just paraphrasing here, because they're very happy people. So if they're making the point that, well, if the aim of life is to be happy, and the Hare Krishna people are happy, it works according to, it's pragmatic. And Srila Prabhupada would often quote that also. And people would be surprised to see how happy. This is the Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam Pavitram. I was speaking on Pavitra this morning. Pavitram idam uttamam pratyakshavagamam dharmyam susukam kartam avyayam. This is the king of knowledge, the king of all mysticism. Here Srila Prabhupada translates guhya as mysticism. It is the purest of all that is pure. It is practically experienced in the happiness that we experience happiness in practicing it. So this is a very high, actually what we're doing in Krishna consciousness is very high level, highest level of spiritual understanding. But that spiritual understanding begins Atato Brahma Jignasa. Now we have achieved the human form of life. We should inquire into the nature of reality beyond Ahara Nidra Bhaya Maitunam Cha. Eating, sleeping, mating and defending. Samanya Maitat Pashubhya Nararanam. Humans and animals eat, sleep, mate and defend. So what is the difference between a human and an animal? Dharmo hitesham adhiko visesham dharmena hina pashubhya naranam. The possibility to, or the actual practice of dharma, is what distinguishes a human from an animal. Therefore, without dharma, a human is just an animal. Sometimes this verse is rendered, instead of the word dharma, jnana. The word jnana is given. That knowledge is the difference between that of a human and an animal. That a human has knowledge or the possibility to develop knowledge. And generally knowledge in the Vedic Shastra, certainly, generally it's employed in the sense not of 2 plus 2 equals 4, or the tallest building in the world is... Which one? You don't know? It's always, it changes every few years because someone always tries to make another one building taller than another. Is it? We were just in Dubai. It's in Dubai. Is it? What's it called? Burj Khalifa. Okay, that's the tallest. We just saw the tallest building in the world. Horrible! Didn't look that impressive. I know, it's difficult to get impressed when you're chanting Hare Krishna. Anything material doesn't seem very impressive. Anyway, it's not knowledge like that. Knowledge means knowledge of reality at the deepest level. Who we are. What is our actual benefit in life? What do we really need to know? Atato Brahma Jignasa, inquiring into the nature of reality, the transcendence, the ultimate. Brahma means Brihatvamiti Brahma, that which is the great, the greatest. What is the greatest? So this is actual knowledge. Srila Prabhupada often used to quote Sanatan Goswami approaching Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, saying, what is that? Loka bebehare amai kahe pandit. That people in general call me a pandit. And I also think I'm very learned, but ke ami ke ne amai jare tapa troi eha nahi jani ke mone hito hoi. Who am I? I'm such a big pundit. I'm supposed to be such. I know so many worldly things, but I don't know who I am. I don't know why I'm suffering the three prongs of material existence. I don't know what's for my actual benefit. People don't think like this. It's amazing, actually, that people go through their life and they don't think, why am I suffering? Why do I have to die? What happens after death? And even if we start to discuss these things, people often protest. They don't want to hear it. Which suggests that deep inside they know there's a lot more to life. There are real questions that they should be asking, but they're blue pill. They've taken the blue pill and they don't want the red pill. Atato Brahma Jignasa. Now, the subject matter to be discussed is the ultimate supreme reality. It's the beginning of the Brahma Sutras, which begins Atato Brahma Jignasa. We have the Dharma Sutras of Jaimini, who's concerned with action in this world for the sake of piety and enjoying this world. Atato Dharma Jignasa. We have the Yoga Sutras. Ata Yoga Anushasanam. Now we shall discuss about yoga, Patanjali's yoga, and Badarayana's Brahma Sutras. Now, when we're finished with the Dharma Sutras and the Yoga Sutras and the Kama Sutras and everything else, then we come to Brahma Sutra. Yato va imani bhutani jayante. Yat prayatyabhisang. No, yato va. Yat prayatyabhisang vishanti. Yato va imani bhutani jayante. Yat prayatyabhisang vishanti. Tad vijyasva, tad brahma. This Atato Brahma Jignasa is a condensation of the Taittiriya Upanishad. Yato va imani bhutani jayante yat prayatya visangvishanti. That from which everything emanates, that in which everything exists, that in which everything enters. That is Brahma, that is the proper object of investigation or discussion. That is the topic of Brahma Sutras. And what is that subject in brief? That is stated in the next sutra. It's giving us knowledge. This is knowledge. When we talk about knowledge, we're not talking about pots and pans and technology. We're not even talking about Ayurveda. We're not talking about astrology. We're not talking about physical yoga or even Kundalini yoga. We're talking about ultimate reality. So what is that? It gives us knowledge. Atato Brahma Jignasa. The subject matter of inquiry is Brahma. Then definition of Brahma, Janmadhyasayataha. Yeah, these two, first two sutras, they're summarized. They're summarizing the statement of Taittiriya Upanishad, and all commentators on the Brahma Sutras accept that. So that is the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam, Janmadhyasya Yataha. The Supreme Absolute Truth is that from which everything emanates, that in which everything, yena jatani jivanti, that in which everything exists, yat prayatya pisang vishanti, that into which everything enters. That is the subject of Brahma, that is the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam, and describes in detail, clarifies beyond any shadow of a doubt, if there is any doubt, that the Supreme Absolute Truth is the Supreme Absolute Person who is to be surrendered to. We enter into Srimad Bhagavatam after going through Bhagavad Gita, which concludes Sarvadhamman Parityajya Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja. Yoga is discussed in Bhagavad Gita, Dharma is discussed, but ultimately one has to fully surrender to Krishna. Then one can come to Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, this is the proper subject of inquiry. And who might come to that point? Bahunam janmanamante jnanavang mang prapadyate vasudeva saravamiti samahatma sudurlabha. Who can come to this point? Someone who's trying to find out what is the ultimate truth. In one sense, we can congratulate the scientists. They're trying to find out what is reality. They're very busy to. They're not content simply to eat, sleep, mate, and defend. They're interested in jnana. At one level, they're trying to understand what is the nature of reality. But because for some reason or other, well, it's historical, it's connected with the Enlightenment, and the Enlightenment means waking up from Christian dogma. That's basically what it means. So, because historical reasons, that religion and reason were opposed. So that's maybe one reason why science, as we know it today, or scientism, is almost dogmatically, and not just atheistic, but anti-theistic. But there's no reason why that should be. If one is actually a scientist, then he should inquire into the ultimate nature of reality, which is given here. It is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That knowledge is given, but that won't be accepted by the scientists, because they want to discover everything for themselves. But bahunam janmana amante, someone who's trying to understand reality, and that specifically means from the Vedic process, who's trying to do that, after many lives may say, oh, it's Vasudeva, and surrender to him. But such a mahatma is very rare. Someone who goes through this process of trying to understand, which in itself is a highly elevated level, to try to understand the ultimate truth. It's very elevated, and someone who goes through that after many lifetimes may eventually accept, yes, it's Vasudeva, it's Krishna, and surrender to him. But such a great soul is very rare. And here you all are chanting Hare Krishna. It's a very high level. We don't realize. It's been made so easy for us that we don't realize what a high level it is. And how fortunate we are to have this opportunity after so many lifetimes. How many lifetimes have we passed in this material world? How many atoms are there in the universe? Is it possible to count? It's not possible to count. In the Bhagavatam, Lord Brahma says, even if we could count all the atoms in the universe, we still couldn't count all the qualities of Krishna. We can also apply that. Even if we could count all the atoms in the universe, the number of births we have taken is more. That's inconceivable, isn't it? Therefore we say, anadi. It's just going on and on. Here we are, we're chanting Hare Krishna. And anayase bhavakoi, Krishna sevan, ek Krishna name pai etadan. Just simply by chanting Hare Krishna even once, we can be freed from the bondage of material existence, attain service at the lotus feet of Krishna, even once chanting. And we have the opportunity to do so. We don't realize how fortunate we are to do this. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to, we definitely need to try to understand and internalize this. Make it one with our heart. Guru Mukha Padma Vakya Chitete Kariya Aikya Arna Kariya Mane Asha. We make the Guru's words one with our heart. Why is that? Why should we do that? Because Guru Mukha Padma, what does the Guru speak? Who's the Ajahn? We begin the song. Sri Guru Charna Padma Kevala Bhakti Sadma. The Guru is one who is the abode of pure devotional service. Speaking brings us to the platform of pure devotion. It's so precious that we need to make it one with our heart. Anakariya manayash, and not desire anything else. Otherwise, we may theoretically be in Krishna consciousness, but we're and whatever we do in Krishna consciousness is to our great benefit, but it's the one foot in one boat, one foot in another boat. Have you seen the rowing boats on the river? They're a little difficult to control, especially if the river is flowing quite strongly. And if the boats are not tied, even if they are tied, they can go apart as far as the rope. If the rope is 2 meters long, then the boats can go at least 2 meters away from each other, and your legs aren't 2 meters wide. So you have to choose one boat or the other, or you fall in. So that's the danger. We have to be on the boat that takes us back to Godhead. The human body is like a good boat. That example is given. Ridehamadyam sulabang sudurlabam plavan sukalpo guru karnadharam maya or mayanukulena nabasvateritam puman bhavabdim nataret saatmaha. This verse is spoken by Lord Krishna, who says that the human body, human form of life, is like a suitable boat for crossing the ocean of material existence. All right, we got a good boat. You have a good boat, suitable, but if you have a boat, you also need a captain and a crew. So in this verse is mentioned the captain, who knows how to guide the boat. The ocean of material existence, such a person is killing themselves. Hari hari bifale janama goainu manusha janama paya radha krishna nabhajya janaya shunya bisha kainu. Narottam Das, who in his life he showed no symptoms whatsoever of neglecting Krishna consciousness. So it's hard to understand why he sings like this. He sings like that out of dainya, the natural humility of a Vaishnava who feels himself very fallen, even if he isn't. So he sings, calling out to Hari, "Oh, I wasted my life. Hariha, uselessly. I got a human life. But I didn't worship Radha and Krishna. Knowingly, I'm drinking poison. Kende bale Amitava Das." This is, we should call out, crying, "I'm your servant." But instead, we may be thinking, "What variety of ice cream shall I buy today?" It may be. Lalit Govinda is not thinking like that. He's thinking what nice items we can offer for Panchatattva and serve to the devotees. It's a matter of changing of consciousness, shift of consciousness. I myself, in my early days when they allowed me to join this movement, I was very interested in prasadam, and that's probably true of many. I don't know how true it is nowadays, because it's all pizzas and cookies and the kind of stuff you can get here, there and anywhere. But it was strictly all Indian style in those days, even though I joined in England. And the kind of food that we hear Mother Yashoda feeds to Krishna, shukta, shakadi, well, we didn't have shukta, or shak for that matter. No, but bhaji, nalita, anyway, what we call Indian items like that. Very delicious. And the secret ingredient is Krishna's mercy. Krishna's saliva makes it extraordinarily attractive. So I was hooked. There used to be a magazine published from New Vrindavan starting from the 1970s called Brijbasi Spirit, and there was a regular article called Confessions of a Prasadam Addict. Because in New Vrindavan they would serve very austere prasad. Actually, that was, we used to hear that was Prabhupada's prescription. 6 days a week, very simple prasad. Chapati, rice, dal, sabji. One sabji every day. But even then, if it's cooked nicely, it's very attractive. So, and then once a week, a full-scale, knock-you-down feast. Literally knock you down.